Hello, and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Weary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
A huge shakeup in Toronto. Rob Ford has pulled out of the race for mayor, and his brother Doug steps in as a candidate for the city's top job. Rob is now running to once again become a councillor after being diagnosed with a tumor in his abdomen.
A lead team of Canadian soldiers with the Special Operations Unit is on the ground in Iraq as our military prepares to help Iraqi forces fight the ISIS terrorist group. Foreign Affairs Minister John Baird is here to speak about our mission in Iraq as well as our role in helping Ukraine during its crisis with Russia.
MPs return to Parliament next week for a fall session that will likely turn out to be a practice battle ahead of the next election. The McLean's panel weighs in on what to expect over the next few months.
We also look at the control the Prime Minister's office has over backbench MPs. Independent MP Brent Rathgaber joins us to discuss his book, Irresponsible Government.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. In a moment, we'll be sitting down with Foreign Affairs Minister John Baird to discuss the serious conflict with ISIS in Iraq and the ongoing crisis in Ukraine. But first, we have to discuss some big news out of Toronto. Rob Ford has dropped out of the race for mayor, and his brother Doug is taking his place as a candidate. The major switch came after Rob was diagnosed with an abdominal tumor.
His doctors won't get biopsy results until next week, but the deadline to sign up or drop out of the election was 2 p.m. Friday. In a statement, the mayor says he could be facing the battle of his lifetime and asked his brother to run in his place because they share the same vision for the city.
Now, this means Rob Ford's reign as mayor is over, but he's not done with municipal politics. He's also announced he's going to run as a city councillor in his home ward in Etobicoke. To discuss this major development, we're joined by McLean's national correspondent Charlie Gillis in Toronto. What's your reaction to the news? You've been following the mayor's race ever since it began, and it's been quite a wild ride on its own accord, but this is just some stunning news. What was your reaction when you heard about it?
Well, you know, I feel like I should be saying that this is a sea change. This is seismic. In terms of the mayoral race, though, strangely enough, the way this is shaken out, it's not. I mean, I think the Tory camp anticipated effectively running against Ford. When all was said and done this fall, and that's what they've got. It just happens to be Doug Ford, but he is definitely the flag bearer for Ford Nation. But in the broader picture, of course, you're right. We look back on these last 4 years, and particularly the last 2 years, it has been just an incredible arc that we've traveled. And you know, I think the city of Toronto has learned a lot about itself in that time. It's learned about divisions between the suburbs and the downtown. It's learned that, you know, that there are, there's toothpaste that you can't put back into the tube. You can't say to part of the city you're going to get a subway and then say, oh, no, you're going to get an LRT and then offer a subway again and keep changing your mind. I mean, so, you know, Rob Ford has taught us a lot of lessons. He's taught us a lot of lessons about what we're willing to tolerate politically if we believe in what somebody's doing, or at least if some of us believe in what that person is doing. So, you know, we're definitely, we've reached some sort of crossroads here. But until October 27th, when the ballots are cast, I'm not really sure that we can say that, you know, we can close the book on the Ford era, or even we've moved on to another chapter.
So Doug is running for mayor now instead of Rob. What are going to be the main challenges for Doug as a mayoral candidate, and what will be some of the advantages?
Doug Ford has a lot of negatives as a mayoral candidate. He's seen as cold and frankly, kind of ruthless. What he has going for him is that he's starting from a better position than that. These last 48 hours, he has really been seen as the caring older brother. And, you know, my own perception of that is that care is genuine. And that's come across. And that's a different Doug Ford than we're used to seeing. He does have a history of saying ill-advised things and getting himself into trouble, most notably his remarks about the police chief. I mean, his repeated attempts to undermine the authority of the police chief and the credibility of the police chief, you know, which to me is a matter of process or, you know, propriety, is just beyond the pale. He has talked about, conferring more authority on the mayor's office. So I think you can look for his opponents to paint him as a kind of an autocrat in making this, somebody that really wants to centralize power and have all the power. and make people do what he says. And, you know, it might not be all that hard to paint Doug Ford that way. My understanding, I've spoken to some people in the rival camps today, and my understanding is that he polls about 5 points lower than Rob Ford does. In other words, you put Doug in place of Rob in a three-way poll against Olivia Chow and John Tory, and he's only about 5 points behind Rob. Now, you know, his opponents seem to think that that's good, that, you know, that's good news. I'm frankly surprised that he polls that high, because he doesn't have that common touch that his brother does. He doesn't exude that sense that he wants you to like him. And that's always been Rob Ford's saving grace, that even when he's saying something that he knows is divisive, that he knows is incendiary, he manages to convey that sense that he's a likable guy.
Some people are asking questions about Rob's decision, and not so much his decision to back out of the mayor's race, but because he's still planning and has submitted the papers to run in Ward 2 as a city councillor, the ward he once held as a councillor before he decided to run for mayor. And some people on social media are saying, well, if your health concerns are so bad you can't run for mayor, how can you run for a city councillor position as well? Is there something odd there that you see with this, or is this typical Rob Ford that he'll never give up and never wants to give up?
He does never want to give up. That's very much in his DNA, you're right. But two things about that. You know, the one thing to remember is that Rob Ford can run in Ward 2 of Etobicoke and win without campaigning. I think that that's a very real possibility. I mean, that's how much goodwill there is to him in that part of the city. The second thing is that I think under the circumstances, this is a pretty intelligent fallback position. They don't have the test results of the biopsy on his tumor. They don't know how serious his condition is. And so, you know, it probably is most important that he focus on, you know, his illness and healing if he can. But if it turns out that, you know, that the tumor is not grave and or life-threatening or even, you know, terribly serious, but it's benign and operable and he can be treated, then, you know, Rob Ford will want to be very much in the political picture. He won't want to be sitting on the sidelines for 4 years waiting for his next turn to come. And so, you know, this is one way of ensuring for them that if he is okay, that he's still part of the scene of municipal politics in Toronto.
And I think regardless of politics and regardless of the way people have viewed Rob Ford in the past, everybody in Toronto seems to be rooting for him to at least make it through health-wise to get better.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you see some nasty chatter on Twitter, and I think that that's to be expected. But, I think most thinking people in the city put themselves in that position. They think of family members who may have had scary medical situations like the one Rob Ford is in, you know, and, you know, I don't think anybody would want to be in that position, and I don't think anybody harbors so much ill will toward Rob Ford that they wouldn't want him to get better.
All right, a very interesting story and always an interesting race in Toronto right now. Thank you very much for joining us and breaking this down for us, Charlie.
Thanks a lot, Cormac.
That's Maclean's national correspondent Charlie Gillis in Toronto discussing the major developments in that municipal election. Rob Ford is out as a mayoral candidate while his brother Doug is running in his place.
There is real concern that this radical militant group is likely to harbor terrorists that may threaten Canada and our allies.
That's Defense Minister Rob Nicholson as he confirmed to the country that a lead team of Canadian soldiers is already on the ground in Iraq as part of a coalition effort to battle the terrorist group called ISIS. Nicholson appeared before a special meeting of the Foreign Affairs Committee on Tuesday along with Foreign Affairs Minister John Baird and Chief of Defense Staff Tom Lawson.
The soldiers who are now in Iraq are assessing the situation before we send in several dozen members of the Special Operations Unit, an elite team of highly trained members of our armed forces. The government maintains this is not a combat role. While the U.S. has committed to airstrikes in Syria, the Prime Minister's office was quick to rule out any Canadian involvement in that country.
On the crisis in Ukraine, the Prime Minister has confirmed the Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko will visit Canada and give an address to Parliament on Wednesday, an honor rarely given to foreign dignitaries. To discuss both the mission in Iraq and Canada's role in the ongoing crisis in Ukraine, Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaks with Foreign Affairs Minister John Baird.
I want to start with the situation in the Middle East. It sounded to me when you were at the House Foreign Affairs Committee this week that the core of your message was when you said that terrorism was the great struggle of our generation, and then added that we don't know how long this struggle will take or how it will unfold. If this is the great struggle of our era, and if predicting its evolution is basically impossible, shouldn't Canadians brace themselves for the possibility of an escalating role for Canada, including Canadian troops?
Well, when I said terrorism is a great struggle of our generation, whether it's Air India, whether it's what's going on in northern Iraq today, or whether it's so many challenges in other parts of the world. This is something that has reached its ugly head repeatedly in recent decades, and I don't think it's going away anytime soon. It's important that Canada, with like-minded friends and allies, work collectively to confront this.
Can we focus in a bit on what we'll actually be doing in northern Iraq? Obviously, the big news this week was that some of our special operations forces will be going into the region. You were in the Kurdish region recently. And
I was.
I suspect a lot of Canadians are just starting to focus on the Kurds and their struggle. Can you tell us something about your impressions, what they've accomplished there?
Well, there's no doubt that particularly the KRG and folks in that region are very brave, very courageous. They're battle-hardened, but they're used to fighting in the mountains, not a more conventional war with a front line. So they lack a lot of the training and expertise that would be invaluable. And I think what Canada can provide is, in part, the knowledge that our well-trained Canadian forces have to, assist them to win this battle.
I'm just getting back to the question about where this could be going. I know that you suggested that it was wrong to make concerns about mission creep or something like that, that the overarching thing that we had to engage in this, and there was just no other alternative. Can you describe what kind of thinking will go into the, 30 days from now, or I guess less than 30 days from now, we'll have to decide on whether to extend the mission. What kinds of factors will you be considering at that point? What will we take into consideration on what we do and how long we stay?
Well, I think first and foremost, it'd be we could never undertake any mission if we were worried about mission creep. I think what the Prime Minister has said is that after 30 days, we'll evaluate how we've been able to assist the KRG and forces in northern Iraq, and whether there'd be value to continue. I'm not gonna anticipate what that decision will be, but we'll probably get the sense of whether there's a value and purpose and benefit to the KRG and others.
Minister, going back to what you told the committee, I was struck by your phrase when you said that the terrorists have effectively erased the border between Iraq and Syria. That sounds about right to me, and yet we see Canada much more directly engaged now in Iraq. Can you explain why, if the border has been erased, our approach looks so much more vigorous on the Iraqi side of it?
Well, I think the challenge is we don't have the capacity to train the forces on the other side of the border, given that the state there has used chemical weapons against its own people, and that it's very difficult to differentiate between the good guys and the bad guys in the opposition. Obviously, President Obama spoke to this, and he'll be moving forward with that aspect.
Mr. Baird, switching to the other major world hotspot we're all talking about this week, Ukraine. There's plenty to ask about. We've got Ukraine's president, Petro Poroshenko, coming to address Parliament next week. Canadian observers going to Ukraine for the parliamentary elections next month. The background for all this is, of course, Russia's aggressiveness along Ukraine's eastern border. You said early this week that you remain deeply skeptical of Russia's willingness to de-escalate the crisis. Is that still where you are today? And can you talk a bit about your perspective on that?
I've been deeply concerned from the beginning of this crisis with Russia's invasion and later annexation of Crimea and the huge destabilizing force that they've had in eastern Ukraine. The whole ridiculous notion that you have Russian soldiers with Russian military equipment, on their own time, on vacation, helping out Russian-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine is ridiculous. Russia is going to have to re-earn our trust and credibility by its actions, not by its rhetoric.
There are new EU sanctions coming into effect against the Russian economy, curbing ties with Russian oil companies, and I think restricting Russian access to financial markets. Should we be watching for anything from Canada on the sanctions front?
Listen, Canada's been a part of more than a dozen rounds of sanctions, and we've argued for strong, tough sanctions, and we will undoubtedly follow suit.
Minister, do you mind if I broaden things or step back just a bit from this? To me, it looked like for a number of years, the foreign policy of Prime Minister Harper's government had two hallmarks. There was a broad focus on Canada's trade and economic interests, really everywhere in the world, and then more narrowly in the Middle East, there was the forceful support for Israel. Now, Ukraine has drawn our attention back to more traditional diplomatic and military ties that we have with Europe, really, really old ones. And in the Middle East, we're looking at this situation in Iraq and Syria that's put the accent again on Canada's relationship with some Arab countries. Does this look like a turning point for you? Do you see this as a point where we're shifting our emphasis and attentions?
I don't know about a turning point, but it's certainly these crises, when they emerge, you don't choose when or where. But I think it's incumbent upon Canada to work with like-minded friends and allies to try to confront bad people doing bad things, and that's exactly what we're doing. I think our efforts in Ukraine and in and around the regional government area of Kurdistan are really reinforcing Canadian values. One, fighting terrorism, which is having a devastating effect on religious minorities, on women and children, and in the other, standing up for the territorial integrity and sovereignty of a longtime friend.
Just on that, connecting those two points, the situation in Ukraine, situation in Iraq, it seems like in both cases you've made a powerful case for Canadian values and interests being at stake. But there's this nagging question in the background about whether or not Canadians, maybe like Americans in a way, are weary of direct engagement, really military engagement around the world. How do you feel the need is to express that, kind of take that into consideration on policy, communicate to Canadians about the need to balance their concerns about us being entangled in foreign places and our need to be engaged where there are principles at stake?
Listen, we don't choose the timing or location of these crises, but I think it's incumbent upon us to act with friends and like-minded allies to try to confront and defeat evil. Obviously, in the United States, they had two wars over a long period of time in which they paid a very heavy price. But in Canada, I think they expect us to do our part on the world stage in confronting the Russian aggression in eastern Ukraine and confronting evil in the Middle East.
That was Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with Foreign Affairs Minister John Baird about Canada's role in the coalition fighting against ISIS and our country's role in the response to the crisis in Ukraine.
Still to come on Maclean's on the Hill, the Maclean's panel discusses the return of Parliament. We take a look at a new book discussing the control the Prime Minister's office has over backbench MPs, and we bring you the good, the bad, and the ugly of Question Period. Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine.
Coming up, we discuss how much control the Prime Minister's office has over backbench MPs, and we speak with Montreal's Mayor, Denis Coderre. But first...
Welcome back.
It's now time for the Maclean's panel, with myself, Cormac McSweeney, my co-host, Aaron Wherry, and Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, John Geddes.
All right, so we have MPs coming back to Parliament Hill on Monday after a summer break. The fall session is likely going to be a sort of a practice battle leading up to the next election in 2015. So, John, what are you expecting out of the fall?
Well, from the government standpoint, I think we've gotten a pretty good taste of what they want to do this week when Finance Minister Joe Oliver announced this $500 million cut in EI premiums for small business. It's the idea of trying to play to what the government has consistently seen as their strong suit, which is economic issues, particularly tax cuts. The other part of that agenda that I think will be prominent, at least for this first month that we're back, Cormac, is the whole question of Canada-EU trade. We have a Canada-EU trade summit lined up for the end of the month here in town. At some point, the government has to get the text of the so-called CETA, the Comprehensive Trade Agreement, out. They haven't done that yet, but we've got to see that soon. And presumably there'll be time for debate in the House, which will be an interesting moment. We'll have to see how the NDP positions itself on this. I think it's fairly obvious the Liberals are going to support it. So I guess from the government's point of view, I think they'll be trying to emphasize their economic bona fides and making that a sort of signature point for the fall.
So, Aaron, what are you expecting? Do you think that some of the parties will be unveiling a lot of their platforms, or at least giving us a vague idea of where we're going towards the 2015 campaign?
Well, we have this commitment from the NDP to start rolling out policy proposals. They've got their minimum wage proposal already on the table. I think we'll start to see those details. I'm very interested to see how far they're willing to go, how bold these proposals are, and how it works out. The idea that you would announce policy this far in advance of an election, I think the conventional received wisdom is that that's a bad idea. It gives parties and critics a chance to really pick their proposals apart. So I'm interested to see how those proposals are received, how far they're willing to go, how the government handles those proposals, and also how Trudeau and the Liberals handle those proposals. The NDP move seems to be a very conscious attempt to be seen as the party of ideas and proposals and substance, and how that contrasts to Trudeau. So does Trudeau come back with his own proposals? Do the NDP's proposals kind of put Trudeau in a bit of a corner? I'm very interested to see how that plays out between the two sides.
But does that open them up to a problem that they've had in the past, where they propose the ideas, another party takes that idea and runs with it, and they lose some support as a result of that?
Tom Mulcair has to be aware of that pitfall, but I guess he feels backed against a wall by the fact that the Trudeau, you know, sort of ascension has just continued. You look at this question about where the NDP positions itself with respect to the Liberals and issues like national daycare, which they have flagged now as a platform priority. That's a really interesting one, because at one time that was a sort of black line signature Liberal issue that the Liberals have gradually backed away from over the past few years. So I'll be fascinated to see how Justin Trudeau positions himself on that. There's still lots of Liberals, lots of Liberal women in particular, who would love to see the party have its flag on that issue, and the NDP is now pressuring them. And, you know, the undercurrent of all this is that a lot of the battle is happening on the sort of left and center-left of the spectrum. I guess to some degree now we're seeing an odd situation where the government, not exactly getting a free ride, but I think the main contest here is between the two opposition parties.
So, Aaron, what do the Liberals do in this? Do they sit back and just watch as the NDP and Conservatives start to leak different policies out of their platforms and wait for the election, as Justin Trudeau has said in the past? Or do you think we'll start to see some more things shape up in the messaging from the Grits?
I would be surprised if they come out with a couple things just to give themselves some substance, just to give Trudeau some backing here. At the same time, if you're the Liberals, I think you just look at those poll numbers. If the poll numbers hold up, if they continue to lead through September, October, November, December, why would you do anything to possibly jeopardize that? If the NDP isn't getting any traction with their ideas, if the government's struggling to get the economy moving, I think you just keep Justin Trudeau on the road and looking bright and shiny and happy and see where it goes.
And then focusing back on the government again, we know a lot of goodies are going to be coming up in the spring budget, so they're going to be waiting for that. But through the fall session, do you think it's the international relations, the foreign relations, the issues with ISIS in Iraq, the crisis in Ukraine, the speech to the United Nations General Assembly, is foreign affairs going to be the main topic for the government throughout this fall session?
I think that, although I've already said they'd like to focus on some economic stuff, they kind of like the foreign affairs file. If you think about 2014, the first half of the year, it was foreign issues that put Prime Minister Harper back on track. You know, he had a tough 2013, and then once the Ukraine started to blow up and he was making forceful statements on the Russia-Ukraine issue, his numbers started to creep up, and his sense of his center, you know, the sense that he knew what he wanted to say, seemed to return to him. So now we've got him talking Iraq, talking Ukraine on a continuous basis, got the Ukrainian Prime Minister coming here. You know, this is all good stuff for him. There is a potential pitfall, though, there. At some point, all this strong talk needs to be backed up with money and possibly even more military action at some point. And those are, you know, harder things to do than just to sound resolute and confident of your position.
Yeah, I think the foreign affairs thing, I mean, I think it's been said by other people before, it's something that the opposition leaders can't compete with. The opposition leaders can't make speeches to the UN. They can't make foreign policy announcements. So that's an advantage. It gets you a chance to look like a prime minister. I don't know how much though it matters if the economy continues to be the way it is, if growth is sluggish, if there aren't jobs being added every month. I don't know how much it matters. And I don't know what, I'm fascinated to see how the government handles this, because I don't know what they do if the economy is sluggish through to the spring. And by the time they announce things for the budget, I don't know if that's enough time to get the economy rolling again before the fall.
Well, we could even see in the fall economic update a surplus again. So yeah, that would be something for them to talk about as well.
One way of addressing that is to try to shift the focus from the current economic conditions to the way people see their prospects for the future shaping up. Mm-hmm. That's a hard thing to do, but it has been done before by governments. You could persuade people not that you're giving the economy traction right now, but that you're the party with a vision for the future. And I think that's another way that the Prime Minister and Minister Oliver may be playing it.
Before we go, one sleeper issue here is the environment, I think. The provinces are starting to make some interesting moves on that. There's a UN climate summit coming up. The NDP is going to conceivably at some point roll out a cap and trade proposal. The Liberals have to articulate a proposal. We have Copenhagen targets to get at. I think that's the underlying issue that is could be major over the next year.
All right, I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, joined as always by my co-host Aaron Wherry, the Associate Editor for Maclean's, as well as Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes.
In June 2013, Brent Rathgaber quit the Conservative caucus after his private member's bill was amended against his wishes. Ever since, Rathgaber has used his platform as an independent MP to talk about what he believes is wrong with the House of Commons and our MPs. He explains his concerns at length in a new book entitled Irresponsible Government, and I spoke with him this week about the current state of the House.
I guess just to sort of crystallize this for people, how are our MPs failing us in your view?
Most members of Parliament, when they get to Ottawa, through some process of either socialization, which encourages them to become team players rather than constituent representatives, or their own vain desire to move up the ladder from back to mid to front benches, whatever the reason or combination of reasons, most members of Parliament adopt loyalty to party and loyalty to leader over loyalty to constituency, or for that matter, loyalty to themselves. And that leads to a situation where members of Parliament cease to be representatives of their constituents and cease to do their constitutional duty, which is to hold the government to account, in exchange for being part of the communication machinery of their own party and their own party leadership. And to me, that's very, very troubling, as under our Westminster model of government, we do not elect our executives, we do not elect our cabinets, we do not elect our premiers or our prime ministers. They are chosen by the Queen's representative. But we do elect our legislatures and we do elect our parliaments. So if the citizenry is to have a say in the affairs of state, it is through that elected representative who's charged with representing that constituency and holding government to account, rather than being a spokesperson for the government. I believe the members of Parliament need to take their role as parliamentarians seriously, as opposed to auditioning for a role in a future cabinet.
How does that manifest itself exactly? Like, you know, you talk about, you know, speeches being scripted or people sort of tossing out kind of planted questions, and your own experience where, you know, you had a blog, you wrote blog posts and the PMO would object to them and get upset. But what is, when we talk about holding government to account, you seem to focus a lot on, and even take a kind of fiscally conservative view of, you know, finances and government spending. Is that ultimately, like, when we talk about representing constituents, is it the government spending? Is that sort of where you focus?
Well, I mean, that's a large part of it. As the book chronicles, I mean, Parliament came into existence in the 13th century in England to put a check on the Crown's insatiable demand for taxes from the commoners. So the government must submit its spending requests for Parliament, and Parliament must authorize it. And as a necessary corollary of that, it's incumbent upon Parliament, on the House of Commons, to scrutinize carefully the government's spending plans. And as we've seen through a number of changes to the standing order starting in the late 60s, shortcuts were implemented and spending plans were bundled into, you know, almost omnibus pieces that did not allow for proper vetting, and then time limits were placed on everything. So Parliament lost control of its initial and primary function, that was to be guardians over the public purse. But more recently, we've seen that inability to hold government to account also enter the legislative process, where rather than vet government legislation like committees are supposed to do, we see whipped votes at committee. Committees no longer do what they did until about a decade ago, and that is work collaboratively to try to improve legislation that had passed at second reading by dotting I's and crossing T's. Now we see partisan points being scored on both sides of the table. So members of Parliament, for the most part, have abandoned their role, which is to represent their constituents and to hold government to account in exchange for serving the wishes of their party leadership by either defending the government or attacking the government for the purpose of attacking it.
Oh, this is obviously a very complicated thing to pull apart and try to dissemble, but you know, there's a few counterarguments here. I guess first is this is a team sport, and party brand and party leader are what voters look for. And second of all, the idea that a lot of things, a lot of these differences of opinion can be aired within caucus. You know, are those not, you know, issues, you know, valid kind of points?
They are, but they break down when they're put to scrutiny. And I address this in my book, and it was a criticism of me long before I left the caucus that I wasn't a team player. And as I think we both know, that certainly stymied any possible advancement to my career when I began to be more of a truth to power speaker than a communicator of the government messaging. But the problem with closed-door meetings and caucus meetings and private meetings with the minister, which are all valuable, but the problem is that invariably in either one of those settings, topics other than the public interest will come into play, where in in-camera meetings, the considerations become, well, what's the political ramifications for this? Is this a vote-getter? Is this a vote-loser? How will this affect our fundraising? So it's that type of political calculation that's done behind closed doors, which is important to political operatives, and it's important to the party, but it's not important to my constituents.
Do you consider yourself the model of how MPs should be? You know, speaking out and voting, you know, maybe against your party in certain cases, or your former party, I guess, in this case, discussing issues, you know, raising complaints publicly. Do you think that more MPs should be like you? Should all MPs be like you?
I don't like the word model, but I would consider myself a traditionalist. I believe in Westminster democracy. I believe that in a system where the cabinet and the executive and the prime minister are chosen by the Queen's representative as opposed to directly elected the way the Americans elect their president and elect their governors, I think it's incumbent on a member of parliament that his or her first loyalty be to his constituents, not to his party. The electorate is beginning to wise up to the fact that their elected representatives are impotent, that they are very little other than the shill for their party. So why engage them? Why even vote? They're not going to do anything to represent me once they're elected anyway, so I'll just stay home and watch a hockey game instead.
That was independent MP Brent Rathgaber speaking about his book, Irresponsible Government. You can find the full interview on macleans.ca.
Still to come on Macleans on the Hill, we speak with Montreal Mayor Denis Coderre, we look at a new book about the 1995 Quebec referendum, and Nick Taylor Vasey brings us the good, the bad, and the ugly of question period. Welcome back to Macleans on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Macleans Magazine.
He's seen as the savior of Montreal, but he's also known as a blunt and tough politician. In this week's issue of Macleans Magazine, Montreal Mayor Denis Coderre sits down for an in-depth interview with Macleans Quebec Bureau Chief Martin Patrickwin.
Just describe a bit the Denis Coderre style of doing politics.
Close to the people. Call a spade, what you see is what you get.
And so three cliches?
No, it's three ways of things that should be done in politics, and that's how you survive. People, leadership is about taking decisions and live with them. It's about also, because you have a lot of people who are talking about, are very cynical and thinking about langue de bois all the time. After all those years. Now, as a new mayor, people deserve transparency. People deserve the truth. And, you know, we used to say, I'm going to say what I'm going to do, and I'm doing what I'm going to say.
I'm about to do one of your favorite things, quote someone anonymously, someone who works closely with you, and I'm negotiating with this person to go on the record, but I'll just read what he had to say. I've never met a better retail politician in my life. His weakness is that his party isn't a party per se, it's a monolith. Nobody has voted out of lockstep with Kader. He's a 60-goal scorer with no bench strength. So I ask, are you a control freak, Mr. Kader?
I'm not a control freak, but if I have a job to do, I'm gonna lead it. And I have a tremendous team. I have a bunch of youth, a bunch of experience. Chantal Leboulot was...
Do they vote in lockstep with you, though? Do they vote in lockstep, as this one said?
Well, we have discussion before, but if we're taking decision and we're taking a decision, you know, our mayor is working. That's it. I've been doing the same thing as a minister. But at the end of the day, I've been elected for all the Montrealers, and my role is to take decision. But frankly, it happened when we take a decision, it's unanimous in my team. But before we're taking the decision, hit me with your best shot.
You are very ambitious, politically speaking. I'm wondering if this office is big enough for you.
You have to find your way. Remember City Slickers? There's one most important thing in your life, but you have to figure it out. Mine was to serve people. And I love it.
To read the full profile on Montreal Mayor Denis Coderre, pick up the latest issue of Maclean's magazine.
Speaking of Quebec, a new book is out that gives Canadians a behind-the-scenes look at the 1995 Quebec referendum. Author and Toronto Star columnist Chantal Hébert sits down with Maclean's political editor Paul Wells to speak about the book The Morning After, the 1995 Quebec Referendum and the Day That Almost Was.
This is an odd book. it is an exhaustive history of something that never happened. Can you explain, first of all, sort of summarize what the argument of the book is, and secondly, how on earth did you think of doing it?
I knew that the politicians from outside Quebec that I was going to ask had never been asked. And I was really curious as to what they would say. And Lucien Bouchard, at that point, had never ever talked about this referendum experience. So I thought if we could get Lucien Bouchard to talk, it would be a good start. And if we can't get Lucien Bouchard, we didn't tell him that. If we can't get him to talk, if he tells us nothing interesting, there won't be a book. So that was the test. But the main reason was to have these voices and these thoughts recorded before some of these voices fade.
Do you start to worry that these folks were at some level irresponsible to not have thought things through more carefully?
It was a shock to us that when Lucien Bouchard said we expected to win, the next sentence was, and was not, here was our plan. The next sentence was, therefore, Mr. Pegizot stopped returning my calls. We never saw that coming. And we had never imagined that. It made us feel like little kids who believed in Santa Claus to listen to that. That was when I realized as a journalist that we'd never really kicked the tires of this negotiator-in-chief title. And if we had, we would have found out that there was no mandate, no discussion, no agreement, no nothing, that Lucien Bouchard himself had not done all these things. So did we feel as we listened to that and then to Mario Dumont saying we spent the last week of the campaign thinking that with a yes vote we would have to slow down Monsieur Pegizot, who he calls le bonhomme, not very respectful. Yes, at that point we thought there was some irresponsibility on the part of people who ask a question and take no pains to make sure that they are on the same page as to what the answer means.
That was Maclean's political editor Paul Wells speaking with Chantal Hébert about her book, The Morning After, the 1995 Quebec Referendum, and the Day That Almost Was.
And now it's time for Nick Taylor-Vasey, the host of QP Live on Maclean's.ca. He's going to introduce a new feature that will be appearing weekly in Maclean's magazine called Inside Ottawa. It'll give readers a look at the action on Parliament Hill leading up to this year's Parliamentarian of the Year Awards in November. To kick it all off, Nick brings us the good, the bad, and the ugly of Question Period.
Question Period should be important. Anybody who's watched even a minute of the parliamentary political posturing would support that basic truth. It should be a relatively simple exercise in accountability. But of course, that's almost never how it plays out. A serious question rarely merits a serious answer, and mostly politicians just bark at each other, their colleagues heckling and banging their desks in predictable waves. Some MPs stand out as statesmen, or at least respectful adults, and QP has its moments. Like any made-for-TV melodrama, it sees its share of the good, the bad, and the ugly. Let's get a taste of the madness. We'll get to the good, but first up, some ugly. Here's Nova Scotia MP Gerald Keddie spitting fury at Liberal MP Chrystia Freeland after she had the gall to ask him about Canada-EU trade.
This is her first question on a trade file. Certainly not a priority for the third party. I also note that she missed 20 meetings of the International Trade Committee and missed 69 witnesses. Now, you want to ask questions on a trade file? You should learn it first.
Sometimes question period takes a turn for the absurd. Here's Paul Calandra, the Prime Minister's occasional point man in the Commons, talking about an evil Liberal plot against every kid's favorite bearded man.
All of a sudden, the Liberals are suggesting that Santa Claus is no longer Canadian and that they would abandon the North Pole, Mr. Speaker. They would abandon the North Pole, abandon Santa Claus. Well, on this side of the House, we're going to stand up not only for my daughters, but for your family as well, Mr. Speaker. For all those young Canadians in the spirit of Christmas waiting for Santa Claus to come.
Occasionally, someone comes along and reminds everyone that the Commons can mirror a courtroom. NDP leader Tom Mulcair, a lawyer in another life, was at his finest at the height of last year's Wright-Duffy affair.
On what date and at what time was the Prime Minister informed that Nigel Wright had made a payment to Conservative Senator Mike Duffy?
Mulcair's questions, serious though they were, got few answers. Only a few MPs are able to get ministers across the way to respond directly to their queries. NDP MP Peter Stauffer is one of them.
To the Heritage Minister, and he's aware of this question, Mr. Speaker. Richard Cassie of Courtney, BC, a CF veteran, asked for his personal medical files and said he received two personal medical files of two other veterans, Mr. Speaker. And I want to ask the honourable member, when is Richard Cassie going to receive his files, because he hasn't received them yet? Will he apologize for that error? And what about protecting the privacy of all our veterans and military personnel?
With regard to Mr. Cassie, I thank my colleague for his notice on this question. He should know I did contact Daniel Cahon, the head of Library and Archives Canada, who is looking into this matter. Hopefully Mr. Cassie will get his information by the end of the day today, and we will look into why false information was sent, because that clearly is something that should never happen.
And then, of course, there's the outright ludicrous. NDP MP Pat Martin and Foreign Minister John Baird took on Canada's greatest national security threat with glee.
Is he working with his American counterparts to develop an international zombie strategy so that a zombie invasion does not turn into a zombie apocalypse?
I want to say categorically to this member and through him to all Canadians that under the leadership of this Prime Minister, Canada will never become a safe haven for zombies ever.
We can, of course, all hope the zombie apocalypse just never comes. But if it does, we'll know our elected officials at least have a place to debate such an existential threat to society as we know it. And when that time comes, we'll yell this from the rooftops with everything we've got. Thank God for question period.
That's Nick Taylor-Vasey, host of QP Live on Macleans.ca.
That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.